Welcome to UBC Insiders On Air for the week of December 18th, 2015, the show that brings you incisive commentary, interviews, analysis, and the best informed rumor mill around on UBC campus life and politics. You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from unceded Musqueam territory in Vancouver. My name is Mayan Kreitzman.
And I'm Neil Janssen. You can always check out our website, ubcinsiders.ca, for written versions of some of what we talk about on air, and an awesome archive full of 8 years of breaking stories and busting balls all over the university.
On today's show, we have our weekly roundup. Former UBC insider Alex Loheed will be joining us for that. In the second segment, we'll have an interview with Philip Steenkamp, who's UBC's brand new Vice President of External Relations and Communications. In our third segment, we'll debrief on the past season with crack radio-producing team Gordon Caddick and Sam Fenn, and hopefully deflect their criticism and get some ideas.
On with the show. To start things off, we've got UBC Insiders alumnus Alex Loheed joining us on the line from Toronto. Both Mayan and I know Alex from way back. Mayan from when they worked together to reform the AMS's voting system back in 2007 and 2008, and me from around the same time when I just hung out in his office a lot. Alex is a former AMS counselor from science who went on to become the AMS VP academic. After graduating, he worked for the Canadian Alliance of Student Associations, a federal student lobby group, and he now works for the Ontario Ministry of Training, Colleges, and Universities. Welcome to the show, Alex.
Hey, thanks for having me, and you're making me feel old there.
Soon I'll start calling you ALO, and that'll make you feel even older.
Right back to undergrad.
So we had to scratch our heads a bit about news for this week, because things are slowing down as everyone leaves for the holidays, but we scraped together a couple topics anyways. Today, I'm still a UBC student. I'm a graduate student here, so I got the UBC broadcast email that was sent out from Sarah Jane Finley, who's the VP of the Equity and Inclusion Office. It contains an announcement about UBC basically hiring an external consultant slash investigator to look into the whole sexual assault fiasco and why that took so long. And it also announces that there will be another announcement in January around a sexual assault policy.
So at this point, does anyone have a count on how many investigations the university has right now? Because it seems like there's a lot. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. It kind of shows some responsiveness from the institution based on public pressures, but...
Well, I think the point is that we're not necessarily supposed to know how many investigations are going on. That's the point the faculty made with Stephen Galloway, is that they should not have announced that he was under investigation. And so in theory, all these investigations are supposed to happen confidentially. So I have no idea how many are ongoing.
There was obviously the investigation into the Bairdell affair. There's the Galloway one. There's this one. So that's three off the top of our heads. But speaking of which ones should be confidential and which ones shouldn't, there was an interesting op-ed in the Vancouver Sun by a lawyer named Ritu Mahil, who was basically talking about these recent scandals at UBC and the balancing of people's privacy with providing information to the community. I didn't really understand from the op-ed if she thought that, for example, with the Stephen Galloway case, if his name should or should not have been released. She just said that, you know, these interests need to be balanced.
What I found interesting about that piece was more so the comments that the university doesn't have policies around some of these things that they're investigating. It's kind of reflective of a trend that you're noticing across North America, where institutions are taking on more and more of like a legalistic, courtish role. There's kind of a growing demand for that, I think, across North America. But as universities set these roles, they need clear policies, they need rule of law, they need jurisprudence, they need all of the kind of legal norms and expectations we expect of any kind of tribunal that can have serious consequences on people's reputations. And
wait, why are universities more and more seeing themselves in these legalistic kinds of roles? I didn't quite get that connection.
The university creates the atmosphere in which a lot of these incidents can occur, and as a result, they're hesitant to bring in external police. They'd much rather deal with it within their own grounds, and yet kind of implementing this stuff in an ad hoc way.
Another piece of news is that Metro Vancouver and UBC have signed a memorandum of understanding about all sorts of nice cooperative things they're going to do together. Neil, any thoughts on this?
I think we should ask Alex, because he can definitely remember a time when relations between Metro Vancouver and UBC were definitely not nearly as friendly.
I can remember a time when the AMS was deliberately driving that wedge between the two institutions. Before I get into that, though, has anyone actually read the content of the MOU?
I've looked into it, yes. It was published on the board website. There's really not much to it, and it's very clear on both that it's not binding. It's just a let's do nice things together document. Do you like sustainability? I like sustainability, too. Let's write our names down on a paper that says we both like sustainability.
That's still much more of a relationship than the two bodies have ever had. And really, an exercise like that is really just to get the two cute, like, individuals to meet and to start talking to one another.
So, Alex, harken back to the time when the AMS was driving a wedge between Metro Vancouver and UBC. What was that all about?
The AMS identified some time ago that a priority for students and for the campus was the maintenance of the UBC farm. And one of the avenues of advocacy that the AMS deployed was going off of campus and rallying a broader community to add pressure to UBC. I remember being at a delegation to Metrovan on the topic of the UBC farm and the future sustainability of the Greater Vancouver region. And Metro Vancouver was very sympathetic and on board. Metro Vancouver, at the end of the day, is a democratic body, and the university is not. And so Metrovan was much more in line with the students who were petitioning and rallying support on that issue. And then they were able to apply pressure to the university as well, and lo and behold, there's still a farm today.
I wonder if that's like a strategy that the AMS should be deploying more often around different campus development issues especially.
Students have to realize that at the end of the day, they represent a large population base that politicians want to attract. And so students, they just need to flex that power. And I kind of fear that at UBC, they haven't been.
And the relationship between UBC and Metrovan has fundamentally changed since the days of the farm. So it's not quite as simple as getting them on side about something. But the whole idea still holds true of trying to build a broad coalition, getting people on your side, so that it's not just you versus UBC, it's you and everyone else versus UBC.
And UBC will respond to the wills of the general public, because at the end of the day, the government of BC appoints the majority of the board, and the government of BC doesn't want its institutions running all willy-nilly against the public will.
So our last news item has to do with U of T. Maybe you have a pulse on this, Alex, since you're in Toronto. A U of T committee that was appointed by their president has recommended a full divestment of the university's money from fossil fuel investments within 5 years. And the question is, will UBC follow suit?
The board agreed to review it after having a referendum of students and a referendum of faculty members both voting in favor of divestment, but that board process seems to have completely stalled, and I haven't heard anything about it in many months.
Right, and so at U of T, there was actually a committee that was put together by the president, and this report is what's coming back from that committee that the administration convened.
So is this going to happen, Alex? Is this realistic?
Well, I can't preclude what the governance of the University of Toronto are going to do. But, I mean, that's a huge, significant step to actually have a committee struck by the president that you would assume has the president's full faith recommending a divestment. It's exciting. It shows that a populist upswelling of support can actually significantly alter university policy for significant public impact.
And I think it bodes well for UBC, because as much as they don't like to see themselves as a U of T copycat, let's be honest, they often are.
I think it's also interesting that we were talking to John Robinson, who was the sustainability provost here and just moved over to U of T. And he was saying that UBC is much further ahead than U of T is around everything involving operational sustainability. But if U of T has taken this step, yeah, that should inspire us to do the same as well.
There's an interesting governance situation here, too, and that is that the U of T, a majority of the appointees, aren't appointed by the province at their governing council. It's much more representative of the faculty and the students in the broader community.
And we should be clear about that, where UBC has a bicameral system where there's a board and a senate, but at U of T there's one governing council that oversees all areas of the university.
Mm-hmm. And it's much more diverse and, I would say, reflective of the population and the stakeholders of U of T. And so as a result, maybe that's one reason that you can file a petition and a lengthy, lengthy, well-thought-out report and actually get a response immediately from the president, because they're going to have to face the governing council eventually.
Gosh, it just makes me jealous of, like, an actual accountable board that's responsive.
I want to give a shout-out because UBC wasn't completely uninvolved with what happened at U of T. Over 100-page-long report that was one of the crowning documents of this decision was written by a UBC alum and former Lord Protector of the esteemed Afternoon Tea Society.
Who is this?
It's Milan Ilmitsky. He's a doctoral student at U of T, and he was one of the key movers of U of T 350.
So, Alex, thank you so much for joining us. It was cool to hear you again.
Yeah, nice to see you guys. And next time in town, I'll give you a shout.
Please do.
Take care.
When you join Balloon Club, we guarantee that you will be able to make a balloon poodle within the first day.
Here at the UBC Ant Club, we just like to talk about ants and compare ant farms. It's really cool.
Paperclip Club is all about, well, paperclips mostly.
At Blah Club, you can blah blah, blah 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 blah.
Explosion!
There's only one club worth joining at UBC, and that's CITR 101.9 FM. We got free tickets to shows, whirly pops, professional help in all types of audio engineering, passes to festivals, crazy parties, live band swag. All types of crazy people. Our programming manager rides a motorcycle. There's freestyle rapping, Nardwar the Human Serviette, the vinyl and record libraries, Discorder magazine, free studio recording, and it sure beats the hell out of Paperclip Club, which is a thing that I just made up because I work at
CITR.
So come check us out on the floor of the Student Union Building. We got all types of crazy shit for you to do. Or check us out online at www.citr.ca.
Since this is the last show of our first season, I thought we could spend a bit of time reflecting about it. Yeah, it's a bit narcissistic, but I personally love a bit of radio talk, and so that's what we're going to do. And to sweeten the self-indulgence pill, we've invited two CITR luminaries to debrief our first season and hopefully give it to us straight. They're basically the Jad Abumrad and Robert Krulwich of UBC. Gordon Caddick and Sam Fenn are the two people at the helm of Cited, an awesome podcast about the connections between academia and the world, which is based right here at UBC. We made them listen to a batch of our episodes as homework, and I'm pretty eager to hear what they have to say. Thanks for coming in, Gordon and Sam.
Hey, guys.
First note, those little chewable vitamin things are way better than sweet pills, so I would go that route.
It's not that one of you fancies yourself the Ira Glass rather than...
No, we both think we're the Ira Glass, I think. Like, I don't even know which one of us would be Jad. Clearly better to be Jad. Sorry, Robert. Can we, like, I don't ever get interviewed, so I'm just going to be impolite and interview you. So why did you... So you have a good blog, so why did you guys want to make it into a podcast?
Well, basically what happened was, I think it was after all the Gupta stuff where I was like, oh, this is kind of fun. So I basically just asked Neil if he felt like starting a radio show. And lo and behold, 2 weeks later, we were doing it. We just wandered into the CITR studio, gave them our idea, and they were basically just like, yes. And it seems like we knew enough about what we wanted to start running with it pretty quickly.
Well, what you guys certainly have is a voice and, you know, a mandate. I think a lot of shows, especially ours, it's like going through a constant existential, like, identity crisis where we don't really know what our beat is or what our purpose is. And you carved yourself out a manageable enough space.
And that was interesting, too, is that although the station has News 101, they're not really UBC-focused a lot of the time. They often focus on Vancouver or Canada news or sometimes even international news. And so there really wasn't a program on the UBC station covering UBC at the time.
So I'm curious, because you've had success with the blog already, what you guys think about the podcast when you listen back to it.
I mean, just to be clear, Neil has basically been running the blog for the last several years. I ran the blog back when I was an undergrad for a couple of years, but I haven't really gotten back into writing much, just a couple stories, I think, this year. And so that's really Neil's domain. And the difference is basically on the blog, Neil does a lot of really dense document digging and investigative stuff, mm-hmm. which is based on his incredible research skills. And yeah, on the show, we talk about that stuff as well, but a lot of interviews and kind of shooting the shit about UBC news as well.
Yeah, we don't really report stories on the show in the mm-hmm. same way that I would report a story on the website. So it's a very different thing. And I would say that there hasn't actually been a lot of written pieces, or as many as I'd like, over the fall, a lot of which has to do with the time that we're putting into this project instead.
You're going to have to, like, combatively ask us questions, or I'm just going to keep asking you questions. But it's like, are you
it's kind of fun to be interviewed.
Are you guys starting to hone in on what makes a good podcast segment versus what makes a good blog post?
I mean, on the radio, right, it's those moments, those honest moments you can somehow trick somebody into slipping into.
Well, no, I think this is where we get to aggressively question you, because what do you think have been our good segments?
I think you're bringing a lot of different interesting voices to the fore. I mean, the last episode that I listened to was the Francis Beulah one with also Simone, and hearing kind of the perspective of Globe and Mail writer that covers national education politics, and having the experts and the community members at UBC kind of interface with those bigger voices. I love that segment, and I wonder if there's ways to do more of that.
Sam, did you have a favorite segment or two?
Yeah, I like the Birdall one. I think that one contains both, like, what I see as the strengths and the weaknesses of the show. Basically, the strengths are clear. She's like a fleshed out, real human when you can hear her voice. Like, I read that story. I watched it go forward on Twitter and, like, on Global and a bunch of different places. And you get used to the kind of, like, really reduced news version of people. Like, she's saying the thing I already know, that she hasn't received an apology, but you can hear in her voice as she says it just the little hesitantness or the little the pause to be a little bit careful or whatever. And those are these wonderful moments in every conversation you have with somebody. I think the best part of a show like this is that it is super nerdy. You guys can go way into the weeds on stuff that doesn't have massive appeal, I'd say, to like most of the world.
Wait, but what's the weakness?
Oh, right. Okay, yeah. I think
Is the fact that we're never going to be number one on iTunes the weakest? Because
no.
Well, we know that. We know it's a niche program. Yeah,
there's a ceiling, right? But, I mean, I think that's, like, kind of comforting in a way. It means you don't have to try to be number one on iTunes. But, no, I think the room for improvement is in, like, the way you set up your segments. In the Birdall one, I'm pretty sure you guys say, like, we're not going to recap everything that happened, right?
Yeah, we did say that.
Which is fine, but I still think you start with a hook. So maybe with the Birdall story, the hook is, last month, a professor wrote a blog post that no one really cared about, and then it got somebody fired. And then you give enough contextual information, short period of time, right? So that if I have no idea what's going on, I can understand everything that takes place in the conversation. And then the last thing is, like, a question that is so interesting that I'm going to have to listen to the segment. I don't know what it is in that case. Can you think of it for the Birdall thing?
I don't really know. I mean, probably something to do with the corporate influence at an institution like this.
Or what's going to happen next or,
yeah.
Or whatever. So you...
So you're saying setting things up with a bit fuller context and maybe some sort of catchier hooks.
And stakes, right?
Yeah,
the stakes. Why people should listen.
I think we get trapped in that because we're sort of dorky. And this is a bit of a push and pull between Neil and I, right? Because he knows, you're like, yes, give me
the
drama.
We're going to get some good tape here.
He knows so much about, like, these nitty-gritty things. And sometimes I'm sitting in the studio and I'm like, okay, if I don't even care about this, then what chance does anybody else have, right?
Yeah, it's a constant battle between trying to make it accessible and make it understandable to people that don't necessarily have all the background in a given issue, but also asking those specific questions so that we are getting new information and not just, let's go over the same quotes you gave to the newspaper.
Yeah, of course. What I would want to do if I were you is start each piece at so accessible that you could be a smart person and this segment's going to make sense to you. And then you try to get as far in the weeds as you can by the end of the 10 or 15 minutes or whatever. And hopefully you bring all the audience with you. And maybe you lose some, but hey, that's like the business you're in is...
Even for the nerdiest of your core listenership, I think having a bit of purpose to the conversation, not just we're going to have someone here that's interesting and important talk about things, but this is a person that's very knowledgeable and we're going to probe this one question. And in the, you know, of course, these next 15 minutes, we're going to try and answer something that, that we don't really know the answer to.
That's a good idea because I think a lot of times we try to cover a lot of different topics.
And what I'm hearing is before we have each guest on, answer the question for our listeners. What's the purpose of doing this interview? Why do we think they're interesting?
Yeah, don't give away the mystery up front, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you like set up a kind of a problem, and then...
Well, we're not serial here.
Yeah, it's like, what's the mystery of the new VP external?
There's got to be some, right? Yeah. Like, there's got to be some lingering questions, or else why bother interview this person?
The other thing that I think can get people along is, I like your personalities and your sensibilities, and, like, that can be infectious.
Yeah.
I mean, Neil, the very fact that you've been doing this website for so long suggests that you're super excited about it and you have really interesting takes on things. I looked at the website today and I saw the application that you had to be a board member, and I thought that was hilarious, and having some more of your character involved. And you see this a little bit in the news updates that you guys do. There tends to be some back and forth. And I think just kind of fleshing those out, even in the conversations, kind of having a little riffs with your guests, showing a little bit more of your personal side, showing a little bit more about your sensibilities.
I think you guys also have the gift that Gordon and I have, which is that you guys are quite different people. The way I see your show, it's got cool mix of a couple of different weird elements you don't expect to be together, right? So on the one hand, you've got really dense information that is enlightening. The second thing that you've got is salaciousness. The idea that you've got these like two different poles is something fun you can play with. And if you're going to have a like argument, do it on the air, please.
Yeah.
You can sound like you maybe argue sometimes. Why do we not hear that as listeners?
Like the time that Neil cut out my question about the pathway from the bus loop, I was angry about that.
Neil, you jerk.
Yeah.
Like, you need to...
How dare you, Neil.
I thought it was boring, yeah.
And then he included some stupid stuff about regulations for height once.
Well, that's a good segue into editing. We were warned when we first started this show that we should do it live because then it takes a half hour and then you leave. And so do you have any comments on like how to produce a good sounding radio show?
Yeah, I think it sounds pretty good. I mean, I think a couple notes in the Eula interview, there were some cuts that were a little quick, I think. You want to avoid that as best as you can. But...
In the Rohit one, I heard a couple clicks in, so it could have been like crossfaded a little bit.
Yeah, it comes with practice. It comes with time. And with time, also, it gets faster.
And I don't think you should dread editing, because editing is really like the heart of the creative process. When you get immersed trying to find the A+ tape, that one moment where the person really comes to life and you're trying to make everything feel organic and paced the right way, like that's where the art of the thing is. So
yeah, no, I definitely don't dread editing. I love doing it, and I actually, whenever Neil is doing it, I'm nervous, right? Because maybe he won't do it right. He probably feels the same way. But
Well, no, I enjoy it too, but it's just undeniably very time-consuming.
Yeah, it's the biggest time-consuming thing. So what about things around interviewing techniques?
You know what? I noticed something.
Yeah.
So who was it? There was a woman that you interviewed, like from the mining industry. Who was that?
Cassie Doyle, the CEO of the Canadian International Resources and Development Institute.
So I think if you go back and you re-listen to that interview, what you're going to find is that actually you ask smart questions, but she begins almost every single clip by qualifying something you say or by taking exception to the way you phrased something, and often doesn't really answer. So if you go back and listen to the construction of the questions, I think you do give her little off-ramps that don't have to be there. There's this guy, John Sawatsky, and Gordon and I teach his method to people at CITR. But one of the things he says, which is really good advice, is you want to start by building consensus. So the one thing I'm thinking of was, you had said that, like, mining has a bad reputation, and then asked some question. And instead of answering that question, she had talked about whether or not mining has a bad reputation. Right. It's true mining has a bad reputation, but there's a way of phrasing it in a way that's completely uncontroversial. You could say, I don't know, you find, like, so-and-so said such and such a thing. Can't argue that they said that, right?
Just make the question as simple as possible so there's absolutely no way to avoid it, to evade it.
And then ask again.
Yeah.
My struggle with asking things in the way that I ideally would want to and kind of building it is that it takes time, right? And instead, sometimes what I find myself doing is packing both my opinion, the background, and sort of my attitude about the whole thing into the initial question.
Right.
And that probably doesn't work as well.
Yeah, because then you have, like Sam said, all these different off-ramps. So if they don't want to answer the question, they can contest your background, your opinion. I think one of my techniques is if someone is giving me a hard time, they're taking a long time to answer, and I have to keep re-asking the question, is just to change your expectations for you, what you can accomplish in the interview. Make it about one thing that you want to discover. This is the goal of the interview. If I leave without it, I've failed. And if we talk about the same thing for half an hour and she doesn't answer, that's going to be a great interview because that's going to be indicative of her more than any other thing that you could possibly do.
Like, I think that's a great point. The biggest piece of advice that someone told me, and now I try to tell myself before every interview, is that this is not going to be the definitive interview with this person. And once you free yourself of that obligation, I don't need to ask everything that needs to be asked of this person. And so what really needs to get accomplished today? And that's a freeing idea, really.
And this is going to be a source of more behind-the-scenes disagreement between Mayan and myself, because formulating questions and the topics we ask about is something that we go back and forth about all the time before interviews.
Do you guys have different tendencies as interviewers?
I feel like my tendency would be to zoom out a bit more and be like, oh, what does this mean for UBC like over the next few years, or for UBC as a whole institution or whatever. Yeah, again, like sometimes I get a little impatient with some of the gorier details. At the same time, those are kind of our competitive edge, right?
Do you think that's right? That's the difference?
I think so. And what we go back and forth on sometimes too is how much to go based on a set of questions that we've written and how much to go in sort of deliberately unprepared and cut in and follow up and say, you just mentioned this. There's times where we found where less is more in terms of preparation.
Being prepared is great, but the truth is that the question you wrote never is the best clip, or almost never. It's the follow-up question that you didn't write where you get people talking like a human being. And so my favorite question, and I've like asked it here a couple times, is what do you mean? I love what do you mean. It always gets people talking straightforwardly. And I think on your show, what do you mean could be really helpful, because you have people say something that in like bureaucratese, and it's kind of vague and abstract. As I was listening to the show, I kept thinking, like, this is where I would ask, what do you mean, to this person?
Well, that's some great advice, courtesy of Justin Bieber. Thank you.
Does he have a song called What Do You Mean? Really? Okay.
Oh, my gosh.
I'm sure they don't play it on CITR.
Maybe not.
Yeah, totally.
Will you guys, like, not just fight, but, like, have a relationship on the air that we can listen to? Could we hold you to that?
Maybe we should just, like, we should read out our texts on the air.
They're just digging for stuff. We get along 95% of the time.
Oh, we it's get not along. That,
it's
like
not that we don't.
Fire.
Yeah, it's not that we don't disagree, though.
I think that the thing to do, even if it's like 2 minutes up top where you guys just chat with each other, and we can feel like you guys are real people who really know each other.
You know, there's a fine balance, though, because sometimes I listen to various less good podcasts, and it's literally just people talking about their day or shooting the shit, whatever, and I'm like, oh.
Well, riff off the material, and, like, you did a little bit of that. I was in the, like, news update about Hotline Bling. I saw, like, a little bit of you, but just kind of developing your personalities a little bit more, making yourselves really likable and really high energy will make people want to listen to this, even if they don't necessarily nerd out on UBC bureaucratic gossip. You'll take them there.
Wait, before this ends, this is like the last show of the year, and we should ask you guys what your favorite segment of the year was.
Honestly, I was listening to the first episodes again, and I was like, fuck, we've learned nothing. These sound just as good as the latest ones. This is terrible.
If you had to just take one segment, pull it out and show it to somebody, which one do you pick?
I like the part where I made Spencer Keys feel bad about not adding me on Facebook like 8 years ago.
There's also a very good clip of tape that I think we should finally include from our very first episode, in which everyone's favorite AMS president, Aaron Bailey, talks about being the genitals of AMS Council. So
very strange analogy.
Like, that probably would have made our show, like Aaron doing some weird genital analogy.
Yeah. I also like the interview with the two Board of Governors reps. I thought that one was pretty good.
Yeah, I enjoyed that. I thought that was one of our big missed opportunities, though, in which we really could have asked a lot harder questions, a lot more difficult ones, like you were mentioning, that are harder to wriggle out of.
Well, are you guys going to keep doing it?
Yeah, saying that this is the last show of the season is a bit of a misnomer, because we're coming back at the end of January. So.
Felt like a good time for self-reflection. Mm-hmm. Since, again, we started this with 2 weeks' notice. We just kind of showed up at the station, pressed record, and it's been so busy doing it that we haven't really had a chance to sit down and think about what we've learned.
Yeah.
Honestly, I think we're both impressed. Like, your first 15 episodes are much better than our first 15 episodes. I think your sound is good. And most importantly, I think it's just like an indispensable service. I mean, the blog is, but also doing a radio show. It's one of the least transparent, least democratic institutions with such tremendous power in this province, in this city. So someone needs to be holding them accountable. Someone needs to be getting into it. That purpose is the energy that will make the show the best, because that's going to keep you driven in the interviews that you do. It's going to keep you asking the hard questions, and it's going to keep people listening. So as long as you keep that mandate.
You're here. Do you need a funny clip to go out on, or will that sentimental clip work for you guys?
Do you have a joke, Sam?
No.
We'll go with the sentimental clip then.
There you go. Yeah.
We've been talking to Gordon Caddick and Sam Fenn, who helped us sum up our season. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Well, that's our show. I'm Mayan Kreitzman, and you've been listening to UBC Insiders On Air, broadcast on CITR 101.9 FM and podcast at ubcinsiders.podbean.com. You can follow us on Twitter at UBC Insiders, check out the blog ubcinsiders.ca, or email us. We're both easy to find on Google. Thank you, Neil.
Thanks, Mayan. Since this is our last show for the first season of UBC Insiders On Air, we're taking a much-needed break over the Christmas holidays. Barring any tantalizing UBC developments, we will return at the end of January with a new roster of guests and maybe some new ideas. If you have any news tips or ideas, please get in touch with us.
Enjoy your break. Insiders out.
Insiders out. I love that sign-off. Good sign-off.